You're listening to the Skadi podcast. Skadi are the financial experts. Our deep understanding of complex financial products and front office expertise give us the ability to ask the right questions for you and solve the problems other subject matter experts cannot see at speed. Whether we've worked as traders or in operations, everyone you'll speak to at Skadi has frontline knowledge and a deep understanding of financial products. We share our practical financial knowledge, analysis, focus, and clear thinking, and we communicate with clarity. We're proudly multilingual. We take great care to make our findings accessible so you feel confident, you understand what's happening, when, and why. Skadi, the financial experts. Thousands of documents shredded, emails deleted, the end of one of the big five accounting companies.
The Enron scandal and subsequent bankruptcy was one of the largest events of its time. The downfall totaled an $11 billion in shareholder losses, making it the largest bankruptcy in history.
To have a stock, you know, the middle of the year trading at its highs and then by December being completely out of business. That is how quickly things unraveled for this company, and that is shocking by any measure.
In the late summer of 2000, Enron share prices were at a high of over $90. Just 3 months later, the share price had been reduced to mere pennies.
Obviously, it got involved in some quite hairy markets, or attempted to, but actually underneath it, there was still a sort of Standard Oil-ish business.
The energy giant was named America's most innovative company for six consecutive years. No one could have predicted the downfall that would occur in 2001. Knowing where to look and knowing the right questions to ask can be crucial for uncovering the fatal chinks in the armour of a huge firm. This podcast episode will serve as your guide through the plethora of factors that contributed to the Enron scandal. With the Skadi team by your side, you will learn how to tackle a beast of a case such as Enron and really understand where the foundations lie in such a colossal corporate cock-up. Welcome to episode 16. Investigating Enron. So, how to begin? Well, there's already a lot of information out there on Enron all over the internet, from detailed reports of financial accounts to trendy hot takes on Twitter. But time is money. It is simply not practical to read things like the extensive 6,000 word entry on Wikipedia. How can we narrow this down to the key important questions? I often find it useful to consider things from the perspective of a child. Adults and professionals can tend to get caught up in the grandeur of complex technicalities and seemingly important details. On the other hand, children have a strong and absolute sense of morality. They tend to disregard any justification or reasoning when claiming something is unfair. This can be useful when identifying the core problems of a complex scandal. To show you what I mean, I consulted my 8-year-old cousin on the matter. After a brief explanation of Enron and what happened to them, I asked him why he thought they went bankrupt.
I'd say the people up top were too smart for their own good. When they started all doing all these smart things with money, they probably got too full of themselves and became greedy. After they got greedy, it sounds like they were then too scared to lose everything they'd done, so they started to do some really naughty stuff until eventually and they got caught.
Now, it might sound odd to say, but with many financial investigations, it isn't actually that often that you find some evil mastermind behind an elaborate plan to swindle companies out of millions of pounds. Instead, what you often see is a situation that snowballs out of control. All it takes is for a few individuals to try a risky idea or venture into uncharted territory. If it pays off, the results can be great. If it doesn't, then there's the fear of wasting a lot of time, resources, and energy. And the tendency here can be to find more dubious ways of keeping it going, rather than reverting back to the drawing board. This is what's called the sunk cost fallacy, where a person justifies their decision to continue with the course of action because they've already dedicated too much resources to turn back now. To elaborate on this concept in relation to Enron, here's Skadi's Managing Director Nick Corey, who's been doing financial investigations for over 10 years.
I think the Enron story for me has so much resonance just, you know, with the day-to-day investigations that we do as a firm when we're helping people. I mean, it's a very human story, right? They're all human stories because there's so many people employed by the company. And this is, Enron is definitely a story about individuals. And I think if we're going to be nice to them, we can say that it started out as individuals being, you know, very innovative, you know, trying hard to, you know, make money, trying to succeed. And then there is a point at which, you know, things, I don't know in Enron whether, I think things start to go, I think the greed kicks in before things start to go wrong, actually. Yep. And I think they start to be greedy first because they're kind of eyeballing success and then thinking, right, how can we really push this to the max? But then they get into a sort of situation, a bit like, you know, when you're surfing, the wave kind of gets hold of you and you're still trying to, you know, retain control and you're going to get toppled over. They find themselves in, you know, effectively, you know, a market that is declining very rapidly. They're getting competition and the tail really starts wagging the dog, and they start getting forced into doing things that probably they may not have done, actually. Even with their greed, they may not have done, but they're really sort of fighting for survival at that point. And I think there are points like that in certain investigations we do where, you know, particularly the ones where we look at kind of over a period of time, and you see that people start out, you know, with the best will in the world, and then as things progress, people start to, I think, get a little bit lazy, a little bit careless, and then you get a point where, you know, that fallibility, that there's a line that's crossed at some point where they then decide, or they could decide to kind of confess and say, we've got this wrong. But rather than doing that, they take a pathway to start covering up mistakes, or, you know, presenting what they're doing in a different way to the outside world, or to other observers, whether it's their management or control functions looking at them or whatever it happens to be. And that's when you kind of then find yourself in any investigation in a kind of, you know, something that's going to be problematic from here.
So if situations are at a danger of snowballing within the financial industry, then why doesn't this happen all the time? And more importantly, who is keeping the snowball in check? This is where the control functions come in. Having a good audit or compliance team ensures that the correct corporate governance is taking place, and this prevents things like front office risk-taking from spiralling out of control. In the case of Enron, their auditor was a company called Arthur Andersen, originally famed as being a member of the Big Five, alongside the likes of Deloitte and PwC. If you're somewhat familiar with the world of accounting, you'll know that the Big Five isn't a thing anymore. It's since been changed to the Big Four, and, spoiler alert, Arthur Andersen is no longer there. After all, the Enron scandal was the largest accounting scandal of its time, and who would hire an accounting firm that was mixed up in that? In fact, Arthur Andersen's reputation was in dire straits before Enron had even been found guilty of its crimes, having lost over two-thirds of their 28,000 employees in the 9 months leading up to the court ruling. Was Arthur Andersen just a poor accounting firm, or might there have been reasons for Arthur Andersen to act in cahoots with Enron?
This is the clear conflict where, you know, Arthur Andersen had people permanently in Enron for years. That's a huge amount of consultancy fees. So, you know, on the one hand, yeah, you wanna kind of highlight problems and so on and so forth. But two, you're very incentivized to kind of keep the gig going, if you like, just from a consultancy point of view, and that's a terrible, you know, temptation to fall into. But I think, you know, that's you know, Arthur Andersen's part in this Surrey story is, you know, the seeds are sown in that, and the fact that they're so reliant on Enron as a customer. I mean, the revenues that must have been generated for the firm by, you know, overseeing, if you like, what they were doing and having so many staff in there, meant that there was a conflict for them.
Keeping the gig going. As Nick has rightly pointed out, this is a very dangerous trap to fall into, not only for the people at the top of the firm like Enron, but for any parties that might be reliant on Enron as a huge source of income.
With any investigation or review, if you need to understand the motivations of the people concerned. And once you start to understand their motivations, then you can really start to think about where could things go to, where could problems lie. So by the way this business was structured and set up and the incentives that were given to the staff, that created the environment for things to go wrong in a big way for Enron.
Thus far, we've established the motivations behind Arthur Andersen's part in this story. But let us look now to the people who were at the very heart of Enron. And more importantly, what was it about Enron's business structure that allowed for their greed to get the better of them? At this point in our investigation, I realise it would probably be useful to know a bit about the background history of Enron, and how the various decisions made for their strategy of their business led to the catastrophic downfall that we've all been hearing about. So, it's time for a history lesson, but only the relevant bits. Enron Corporation was founded in 1985 by a man called Kenneth Lay. It was part of a merger between two American energy companies. Enron was both a natural oil company and a gas company, with the vision of becoming the premier natural gas pipeline in America. In 1987, Enron Oil reported its first major loss of $85 million. This was actually later discovered to be more like $140 to $190 million, causing two top Enron Oil executives to plead guilty to charges of fraud. But more on false reporting later. In 1989, Jeff Skilling, a consultant at McKinsey & Company, had the brilliant idea of linking natural gas to consumers in a way that effectively turned natural gas into a commodity. Enron adopted this idea and called it the Gas Bank, hiring Jeff Skilling to run it. This allowed Enron to become a market maker for natural gas, as well as introducing it to the business of trading. In 1991, Enron adopted a mark-to-market accounting. Although this may not be the very beginning of the slippery slope, it certainly marks a point in which the slope starts to become visible, from an investigation's point of view.
Well, one of the features about the contracts that Enron was involved in and this mark-to-market accounting was that it wasn't possible really to have an observable price for a lot of the stuff that Enron was dealing in. So that leaves you with sort of mark-to-model, which, you know, you can sort of say, well, there is some backing to it, but generally a lot of this stuff is quite easy to, you know, manipulate, extrapolate, or, you know, if you're going to be fair to them, then the price is very uncertain. And, you know, that I think that is the case. You can see evidence of that in the market today, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I think you can. I think you've seen a lot of money made in the private markets. You've seen a lot of money lost this year in the public markets, which do take a daily mark to mark, even though they take a minute to minute mark to mark. A lot of these, in inverted commas, maybe unicorn type tech businesses, where they raise money at X and then they raise money 3 months later at 5X. You know, if you've investing in every round, well, you can mark your book up every round that goes on by, you know, hopefully participating, therefore seeing what price it struck on, going, well, you know, we own 10% at, you know, at the original, which we went in at, you know, on day one, and now they've raised money at 10 times that. Well, we're going to mark our whole book up there. You know, that's, it'd be interesting to see how this year and the next couple of years really pan out from that perspective. And if you, as you say, you know, the sort of classic history rhyming, will things get uncovered in this downturn that we are now seeing? We've certainly seen it in the crypto world, which does mark to market. But I suppose going back a bit to what you were saying before, you know, anyone that started talking about crypto about 2 years ago or a year ago, everyone got very excited. Their share price might even have ticked up. You know, you now look at the sort of bombshell that's gone off there. All these things are being quietly marked at zero because a lot of these things have been shown to be completely worthless. But everyone got very excited in the sort of in the new world that theoretically crypto was about to bring to everyone.
So we've been casually banding around this term mark-to-market accounting as if it's a bad thing. But in reality, as director Damian Taylor just pointed out to us, it's a commonly used practice within the financial markets. But why did Enron executives change this strategy, and how did it later pose a problem for Enron? To highlight the importance of this method for Enron's accounting scandal, and to prevent you, the listener, from falling asleep, I will now explain how Enron used mark-to-market accounting with an intense backdrop of escape music. Mark-to-market accounting is where the value of assets and liabilities are recorded on financial statements at their estimated fair value, rather than being at their historical cost. This method can be used to manipulate a company's financial performance by overstating its assets and understating its liabilities, making a company appear more financially sound than it actually is. In the case of Enron, the company used mark-to-market accounting to conceal its losses and make its financial performance appear better than it actually was. In other words, Enron reported profits for long-term contracts as if it was their current income, even if those profits were not expected to materialize for a very, very long time. This allowed Enron to inflate its earnings and make its financial performance appear even stronger. Many of the executive pay was linked to the performance of the Enron share price, so they had a very high incentive to use this strategy. Additionally, Enron used a complex web of partnerships and off-balance sheet entities to hide its debts and losses from investors and regulators. The company was able to transfer debt and losses into these entities, which were not reflected on its financial statements, giving, yet again, the appearance of a stronger financial performance. So, what's the upshot of all that? Well, for starters, Enron did eventually get found out. With CEOs resigning, the stock price falling, and Enron reporting major losses in 2001, the end drew near. On the 22nd of October, the firm came under probe from the Securities and Exchange Commission, forcing Enron to swiftly reveal that it had been inflating its own stock price since 1997. On the 2nd of December 2001, Enron filed for bankruptcy. The Enron scandal has highlighted the dangers of mark-to-market accounting and the importance of transparent and accurate financial reporting. It's led to increased regulations and oversight within the industry to prevent similar incidents from occurring in the future. Here's David Bridges, SCADI's operations and middle office subject matter expert, to talk about how some of these regulations have affected practices within the financial industry.
The Sarbanes-Oxley Act, also known as SOX, was introduced off the back of the financial scandals in the early noughties, such as Enron, which we're discussing today. Now, the Act was passed in the US in 2002. It was put in place at a time when confidence had been shaken, so the objective was to safeguard investors from fraudulent reporting. Now, whilst this is a large piece of legislation, one interesting point of note is found in Section 404 of the Act. Now, this is a requirement for management and auditors not only to have established internal controls in place, but also to make sure that they employ reporting methods to ensure the adequacy of those controls. This is something I've worked on at Santander's Investment Bank, where I was responsible for the certification of a suite of controls in place for all of our outsourced activity. Now, when we think about offshore functions, it really is crucial that the governance that sits in London, that oversees those functions, can attest not only that those controls are in place and that they're suitable, but also that you can prove that there's sufficient metrics in place that can monitor that these controls are being followed correctly. Now, this wasn't a tick box exercise or something to be underestimated. Any failure to comply by our periodic deadline or any deficiencies that we found would have to be reported to the board. And it was at the board level, it rested on their shoulders when the annual reports were filed to make a statement with an assessment of just how effective the internal controls were.
A glimmer of hope for the financial industry. After all, learning from our mistakes is crucial for success moving forward. Unfortunately, though, the financial world is ever-changing. In the last decade, we've seen a rapid uptake in the world of cryptocurrency. However, as the recent FTX crash has shown, there's much to be done in the regulatory space of modern financial markets.
I mean, people are drawing real kind of comparisons between FTX and Enron, particularly because of that paper that was written by the guy that's come in to be the CEO of FTX because of his involvement in both. And the things that he said. But, I mean, I truthfully don't know too much about FTX, but as I look at it, I think I'm looking at a situation where you've effectively just got someone who's very immature, given far too much success, and therefore, you know, just didn't have any kind of corporate governance or any kind
controls whatsoever.
Any controls, etc. But I don't think that was born out of trying to do a fraud. I just think that was born out of just being, you know, completely inept, basically, and unused to a situation. Whereas I do think that in the case of Enron, you know, there you had people that were experienced in business that kind of used that experience to perpetrate, you know, bad things. I don't think there was any experience at FTX to kind of perpetrate stuff. I think they were just doing stuff that was outside of accepted norms, because they probably, from a conscience point of view, probably knew that they shouldn't have been buying their parents', you know, properties in the Bahamas with companies' money. But I can sort of see why that could have happened. Do you see what I mean?
Yes, I do. I think it's, I mean, the FTX story will rumble on for a bit, and I'm sure lots of comparisons will attempt to be drawn. It'd be very interesting to see how it pans out. I mean, did he start it out naively, as, you know, with good intention? Quite possibly, yes. And then, as you say, it's maybe just then sort of snowballed, and then he can. There's a lot of sort of regulatory arbitrage that goes on within crypto, and I think part of that was that. So obviously it now turns out that the lines between FTX and Alameda were completely blurred, where they were supposed to be sort of completely separate entities. It's, you know, watch this space, really. I think it can be quite hard to opine too much on what's gone on.
Yeah, I mean, I think ignorance is no defence.
Yeah.
But I think he was ignorant.
Yeah.
I think that's what's going to turn up. I don't think he deliberately tried to blur the lines between the two. I just think he just had no idea of how to run a company.
Mark Twain once wrote that history never repeats itself, but it does often rhyme. And whilst the Enron scandal and the FTX crash have their differences, we can definitely use the similarities from both to help us make better decisions in the future. As we draw our investigation to a close, it's important to look back at the event with hindsight. And so, my listeners, I leave you with Nick Corry reminiscing with Damien Taylor about their memory of Enron from a London trading floor.
I do remember Enron happening, but it wasn't something that I felt impacted my own positions that I held at that time. I don't think there was a kind of contagion into stuff that we had at the time. That wasn't really the case, but there's certain things that I do remember when I read back through the, you know, the story of Enron, and, you know, thinking about the online dealing, you know, the online commodities portal that they set up that was so successful and added so much to the stock price. And I remember that very vividly, because you and I were doing ING's e-business strategy from a trading point of view. And, you know, if you remember, there was a period where you'd be sitting there, and we were trading a pairs book at the time as well. Yeah. It was long and short financials. And it was like landmines going off, where you'd have a bank would announce an e-business strategy and their stock would go up 10 to 15% just on the announcement. And that was pretty hairy stuff because there was no rationality to it. There was nothing behind it. It was just people were under pressure to announce these e-business strategies, these online trading strategies. And that really kind of, you know, I remember that part of the market very vividly. The other thing that I was sort of interested in the Enron story was the timeline, because it's all happening, or certainly the unraveling of the company is happening around 2001. And, you know, by August, things are going pretty badly for the company. And then the timeline kind of rattles through into October, and there's no mention of the impact of September the 11th, which impacted the whole market. And maybe that's the point. Maybe it just impacted the whole market. So Enron was no different, really, in that. But of course, it's, you know, it was very focused on power, focused on energy. And energy is such a big, I get, you know, what you learn and what you're seeing now in the recession now is that it can cause huge volatility to energy prices, because you have this kind of speculation or people trying to predict where is demand, what's demand going to be like. And that can, you know, in energy markets that are very forward looking, that can really take, you know, the steam out of the market and cause prices to fall very rapidly. And I think that's, you know, one part of the Enron story that was very hard for them. And of course, that, you know, I'm treating them as if they were like, you know, whiter than white. They were doing all sorts of awful, you know, manipulation strategies on the market. They were the kings of market manipulation. But no matter how much you manipulate, there is a kind of the underlying force of the marketplace. And when you had the bursting of the dot-com bubble, which is what was happening at that time, followed by the kind of, you know, the September the 11th sort of shock that kind of killed off demand. And I do remember that happening, you know, thinking about demand in travel and so on, took a real beating. Then these are headwinds for any energy trading business, you know, which was the heart of what they were doing. So I do remember those parts of the Enron story, if you like. And then it was only later, you know, as the sort of further revelations came out over time, which didn't come out at the time, but, you know, years later, like fake dealing floors and all this kind of stuff. Then, you know, that's just sort of part of the kind of amazing story of Enron that kind of emerged later as people carried on, you know, reviewing the situation.
You've been listening to the Scardi podcast, written and produced by me, Coleman Corrie. Joining me in discussion today was Managing Director Nick Corrie and Director Damien Taylor, with features from our operations expert David Bridges and my cousin Rory Tate. If you want to listen to more episodes, go to our website at www.scardilimited.com or simply search the Scardi podcast on any streaming platform.